This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today, we talk about the importance of craft and how the tradition could help us rethink manufacturing moving forward. Isn't it time we bought fewer but better products and took greater pride in where and how things are made? I, for one, think so. First, I speak to our Tokyo bureau chief about how craft can survive and why it's important that it does.
It could be a tea caddy that's made in Kyoto. It looks lovely when it's made, brand new, but it looks so much better 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. It gets a patina.
Plus, we speak to our near neighbour in London about the importance of meeting your makers and keeping supply chains short.
We would happily make everything in the UK. I mean, you know, the closer you can make, the better in our view. If we could make everything here, from even local timber, amazing.
That was Paul Deswart from Marylebone-based brand Another Country there. All that's coming up right here. Here, plus the folks behind one of our favourite Aussie furniture brands too. All to come on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. And I'm delighted to say now that I'm joined on the line by Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, excellent to have you back on Monocle on Design. I'm sitting looking at a rather fetching book, which I believe consumed most of last year for you in the Tokyo office. And now you have the unenviable job of talking about the book for the year after you spent a lot of time making it. The Monocle Book of Japan is published by ourselves, but also by our friends at Thames and Hudson. And the topic for today's show is Meet Your Makers. It's about the resurgent world of craft, how much of it we can salvage, how important it will be to us moving forward. And I just wanted to ask you, Japanese craft and craftsmanship is renowned around the world from the advent of wabi-sabi, leaving things a little bit rough and unfinished as part of their perfection. But why do you think Japan has this incredible reputation for making things and kind of making honest and interesting things as well?
Well, it's a very well-deserved reputation, I have to say. It's one of things when I first came to Japan, I was just so bowled over by the diversity of craft and the quality. Obviously, you know, ceramics, wood, lacquer, and they're made to a level of such perfection. And there are many reasons why craft has really evolved in Japan. One of the very simple reasons is this amazing topography of Japan. I mean, Japan is about three quarters covered in forests. I know we always see Tokyo, but three quarters of Japan is covered in forests. And about 65% is mountainous. So you've already got areas very cut off before there were roads and Shinkansen. These areas are very cut off in the winters. Farmers used to pursue these crafts when they weren't in the fields growing rice. I've been to many places in Japan where crafts developed that way, and people never really left these villages. Small villages where maybe they're making a very specific kind of ceramic. And also Japan was very regionalized and continues to be so. Japan has 47 prefectures, very proudly, and each prefecture is quite different from the other one. It really is important to these prefectures that they have their own identity. And for people who know anything, say, about ceramics, if you look at a piece of pottery from Japan and you know anything about it, you'll know exactly where it comes from. They're very, very different. And if someone is sitting in one bit of Japan and they suddenly think, I'm going to make, say they're in the north of Japan and they think, I want to make Okinawan pottery, it would just feel wrong. It's really tied into the local materials that were available way back when and still available. And these styles have developed and evolved and they haven't really changed. So it's fantastic if you travel around Japan. You can see all these crafts very much alive and still much as they were, slight tweaks of modernization in some places, but it makes for a fantastic voyage around the country.
You mentioned the regional expertise. There might be a region that makes towels. There might be a region that specializes in ironware, nambuteki, I believe it's called. I've ventured a bit of Japanese there. But I wonder, from the stories you met and the people that you spoke to, are these crafts kind of alive and well, or have they been stored in aspic? Have they been kept? And are there enough kind of apprentices to keep this going and keep it moving for another generation, do you think?
It's a mixed picture. I would say in many places, people really appreciate Japanese crafts in Japan. So there's a big domestic audience. Now, there is a general situation where people are moving away from the countryside into the cities, and that's a bit of a problem. So you don't necessarily these days get the son taking over from the father that happened for many generations. Not always, but I've seen that in so many places it is still the case. And what I've noticed recently is that I would say craft has become quite fashionable. So it used to be that people weren't that interested in Japan's craft. People in Japan weren't so interested. They started to think, wow, everything that comes from overseas is great. A big sea change since I've been in Japan is that young people are thinking, wow, look at all this amazing stuff we make here, wooden furniture, you know, these beautiful ceramics, glassware, iron casting, whatever. I mean, Nambuteki is a good example of something that's become quite sort of fashionable. And I think one place I went to in Kyushu, one very small village where they make, it's a kind of pottery called Ontoyaki, very kind of brown, very earthy looking. I absolutely love it. And I've got loads of it. They said they've got so many people who want to be apprentices now, they can't take them because they can't really afford. You're not in craft to make a lot of money. They don't consider themselves artists. They consider themselves artisans. And really, it's not a big money spinner. They do it for the love of the craft and really for perfecting that. And so it's quite difficult. They can't take on loads of apprentices. But it is, you know, in Ontoyaki, it's become so fashionable what they do, much to their amusement. I have to say, they didn't quite get it, why everyone in Beams is buying Ontoyaki. But they said, really, it's hard for them to take on a lot of apprentices. And ideally, what they want is a son, you know, or a daughter. But traditionally, it was father to son to take over. I mean, there are, you know, of course, other examples where there isn't a successor. And, you know, these are crafts that really you have to be doing from when you're knee high. You can't suddenly decide a career change. I'm going to start making magewappa, this amazing bentwood craft, which I've seen in Akita in the north of Japan. That's very much a family business. Or Seki in Gifu in the sort of middle of Japan, where they've been making knives for 800 years. These are very much family businesses, but some of them have become slightly industrialized. The knives are a good example. You've got Kai, which is the huge knife maker. They make many kitchen knives close to Seki. You've got the very traditional craft and where it's become a more of a, I wouldn't say mass market, because Kai also does extremely high-end knives. You know, they are also tapping into that. They need the craftsmen, that even these big industrialized companies, they need the craftsmen. So that's important. They have to be close to them. You know, you hope there's a good future for these crafts. It's very much valued here. And interesting of this huge rise in tourism that we're often talking about in Japan. Tourists want to buy the stuff too. It's sometimes you have to explain to people why a very small piece of wooden something is so expensive, but it's exquisitely put together. It's made from a very rare, you know, Japanese cedar, whatever it is. And it's taken someone 50 years to perfect the technique. So it is worth the money you might have to pay for it.
Yeah, amazing and really incredible insights there. I love this image of this kind of faintly amused ceramicist saying, why is everyone so interested in this thing that I do all day, every day? That's actually quite hard work and low paying. I guess there is this sense that globalization has made it very easy to get lots of things of a low quality and of dubious provenance, which has made us all think perhaps again about what we value and what we surround ourselves with. Just a very final question, Fiona. The June issue of Monocle magazine is also out now, something which you have also been involved in, as well as the Monocle Book of Japan. And it's about a bit of a global rethink, about taking some time where we might be at home a little more than we would have been before, where we're in unusual circumstances, to maybe kind of augur a little bit about how we can move forward. It seems to me that the buying less but better things, and also the idea of quite small supply chains, making things by hand in a kind of limited number, has always been quite central to Japan. Do you think this is something that people in Japan will appreciate more after the lockdown? Will it just continue? What do you think the world could do with maybe looking at Japan and saying, well, actually, all our stuff stuck in shipment containers coming out of China, that's not the best way to make things. Maybe we should look back to craft, maybe not head quite back to the hills, but, you know, keep the supply chain short and keep the materials honest and interesting. Can we learn from Japan?
I mean, definitely. It's such an interesting point, isn't it? And I think it's really true that longevity really is that sustainability, isn't it? Making something that lasts. And to make something that lasts, it has to be very well made. And often people relate it back to using natural materials. They last. And I think there's so much truth in that. If you look at, maybe it could be a tea caddy that's made in Kyoto. It looks lovely when it's made brand new, but it looks so much better 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. It gets a patina and it functions just as well. And that's where I think sustainability lies. Now, not everybody can perfect a Japanese craft, but I think that attitude of looking at things really and looking at longevity, long life design, that's to me is the way forward, not constantly replacing things. I think that's where craft really can teach you. And you can go to places and you see these very old bits of ceramic, wood, paper lanterns. Now, you wouldn't think a paper lantern would last, but they really, really last. They're so well made. They're surprisingly robust. Traditional Japanese paper is much tougher than it looks. That's got a lot to teach the world. And I think that obviously Japan is very lucky. It has an amazing variety of craft. So you've got every kind of example of craft here. Well, I always feel very lucky. And our office is actually very close to the Mingeikan, the folk craft museum. It's great just to pop in there. That the ceramics, they look as fresh as when they were made. They're very, very simple. They're unknown craftsmen, nothing fancy about them, but they're just really solid, and you could use them today as you could have done 100 years ago. And I think that's really appealing to people now, particularly after all this that's happened.
Artful answers and crafty insights there from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. The Monocle Book of Japan is published by Thames and Hudson and is available to buy now. I'd implore you to do so. Coming up, we pit stop in Australia and the UK to talk to the folks behind furniture brands making quality and craftsmanship their top priority. Do stay tuned. At a time when our homes are more important than ever, the items that furnish them should bring both comfort and probably a sense of meaning too. The folk behind Aussie furniture and design store Living Edge certainly think so. This show's researcher, Nick Manise, caught up with Aidan and Joe Mawinney, the husband and wife team behind the brand, to discuss the importance of craft.
So Living Edge was founded in Sydney in 1998, and you've since established outposts across the country, you know, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth. In that time, a lot of your work has entailed collaborating with designers, whether that's furniture makers on bespoke pieces or working with architects to find items for the spaces they're creating. Do you think we're now at a moment where people are going to be demanding of architects or even of themselves to look for items that are going to last?
The more attention globally, you know, if you look at this whole face mask situation, and now they're ending up in rivers and the ocean, plastic is becoming a hugely widely known problem. Like from a while ago, people, it wouldn't have affected their purchasing decisions. But now I think just with the sheer volume of information out there about what we're doing in terms of damage to the planet, people have to change their behaviors. You know, if you look like IKEA, you know, great business, but just huge, colossal in their size and what they're, you know, what they're eating up. And the waste that's becoming part of that. I mean, I don't think anyone goes into IKEA thinking that they're going to have a piece of furniture forever. And that's fine, absolutely fine. But I think people are now questioning, well, if I keep going through this, can you just buy it once? Can you make an investment and get something to last a bit longer? I'd love to say that we're at that point. I still think, unfortunately, people expect bespoke or well-made items for mass-produced pricing. And that's where there's a real dichotomy here where people, you know, expect everything but willing to pay nothing. And really that's where there will need to be a shift in value. You know, if you want to buy it once, as we've always said, you know, if you buy once and buy well, basically that well part of it is you're going to get longevity out of the product.
I mean, Joe, I know a lot of your work is customer facing. Could you maybe give us some examples of people's behavior and how they're starting to build these items into their homes?
I mean, I've worked in this business for many, many years and, you know, my own home here over the years, I've just got a little piece as I've gone along. And then 20 years later, all of a sudden, you really have some pretty cracking stuff that, you know, is impressive. It's still beautiful to look at. Like I've had an Eames Lounge Ottoman myself for years, but even our customers still talk about theirs that they purchased so long ago and they've all the kids have gone all over it and the dog and the cat have scratched it up a little bit. So there's still... You know, I think the big discussions around sustainability and quality, but there's also this love of the product as well. I think that our suppliers are producing with these really beautiful designs also.
I mean, you mentioned suppliers and supply chains there. Aidan, could you maybe explain a little bit about your relationship with your suppliers? You know, do you think it's important for people to know who's making their furniture? And how does this factor into people's decision making?
I think personally for people, I mean, we all do this. It is absolute human trait to know the story behind something. You buy something perhaps because it looks nice, but generally you buy it because you can talk about it. Your friends come over, you can talk about why you bought it. You can talk about the purchase. You can talk about the product itself. It's the stories that go along with that. You know, and if we use that one piece of furniture, you can talk about the designers, the manufacturers, the production process. any element, there is so much content to talk about in furniture, in one piece of furniture. So yeah, I do think very, very much so. The stories behind and the people who make it, whether it's a locally designed piece by a local Australian designer, young, old, whatever it might be, to, you know, an international famous designer or just an up and coming designer. It gives us all something to connect into that product with and then to talk to other people about. And I think without any stories, we're buying disposable items that we have no emotional connection to whatsoever. If you just have a piece of furniture that really has nothing attached to it, it's a very short afternoon, you know, sitting down to beer and talking to somebody, to each other. You've got to think of something else. And I think people love to surround themselves with, whether, again, it's the clothes that they wear, the cars that they drive, whatever it might be, the hobbies, the passions, the camera that they own, you know, it's connected and it's the inherent value within that piece. And it gives something to connect to and to talk about. And I think it is imperatively important.
And again, just to throw to you, Joe, could you perhaps maybe walk us through another example of this?
I think Beth Ingrave, she's based in London, actually. She's a Welsh designer. Probably one of our most interesting products from a story point of view and manufacturing side. And it's handmade in Amman, and it is absolutely beautiful and stunning product, as well as beautiful and stunning manufacturing as well. So, I mean, the story of her background and her passion for this product is incredible. So I think we had Bethan, she was here, I believe, last November in Australia and did a tour. And the impact of her visit was huge. And it got a lot of designers into the store to look at it. It was a credenza, for instance. If you don't know the story of this, you think, oh, it's very beautiful, it's very pretty. But when she was really describing all the petals and how it's hand cut and it's inlaid brass and all these very special details that not many manufacturers can actually even achieve anywhere in the world. She was so engaging, and the designers then could speak to their clients about, this is why you should invest in this piece, because it's a unique piece, it's a one-off, we can customize it, all this kind of thing. So, you know, the detail behind it is what gets people across the line, that's for sure. And also it's something that then they will have in love forever as well. It's not a piece that's a throwaway ever. It'll be handed on to their children or grandchildren or something like that in future. You know, these pieces should live on past yourselves to a certain degree.
That was Aidan and Joe Mawinney of Australian furniture brand Living Edge talking about the importance of provenance with Nick Manise. Finally on the show, we mull over a contemporary take on craft that's kept manufacturing close to home. Another Country is a go-to furniture brand for those who appreciate just-so workmanship and seemly design in the rich tradition of Shaker furniture and Japanese woodwork. Founded in 2010, Another Country is fastidious about quality and keeping supply chains short and transparent. So, does making something once and well counter sustainability? And will people pay more for things that are made better? Maylie Evans spoke to Another Country's founder and managing director, Paul Deswart, to ask about the importance of the journey that each and every product takes.
Provenance is history. Provenance is knowing where something comes from. You know, it is the connection to a heritage, to a tradition. You know, provenance is knowing where the origin of an item or an object go back to. You know, and it could be a maker's origin, it could be historical origin, it could be material origin, something specific to a region, something designed specifically by a certain design tradition or a school, something historical that is linked to a place or a location. So to me, provenance is being able to identify one of those factors. The brand was founded, it came out of a search for a perfect archetypal stool. And I was looking for something with provenance, reasonably priced, well-made, and archetypal in design, and so that it would last qualitatively as well as aesthetically. Happy to pay a good price for it, but not a sort of designer price. And oddly, as sometimes these things happen, the more I looked, the more I realized there wasn't anything like it on the market. And there started the idea of the brand. Dom was a friend of mine, and he still works in the village near our house in Wiltshire. As I was thinking of a maker to make the prototypes of the first series that I had by then designed on the basis of the stool, the design is slightly modular, so the legs are shared between a daybed and a coffee table and a stool. I had these drawings and I was thinking, well, who can make these for me? And I realized that, of course, I knew Dom is a fantastic maker, and Dom and I became partners. He was excited about the prospect and the idea of a sort of production line, because he essentially is a cabinet maker, so it's all commissions. And off we went. The first series, still called Series 1 and still the best-selling range, interestingly, was all sampled by him in the workshop.
The stylistic influences for the brand, shaker, a bit of Japanese woodwork in there. Could you tell me what it is about those traditions that appeal to you?
I think it boils down to an appreciation of the material and a respect for the material. It also boils down to the mantra of less is more, so really focusing on simple shapes, letting it be timeless by not making it too specific to an era or trend or a fad. All these traditions you mentioned have a beautiful sort of background, both in the skill of making, craft, and design with timber. So whether it's a shaker tradition in North America, whether it's the mid-century Scandinavian design that we're all familiar with, as well as, you know, the amazing Japanese skill in woodwork. And also, of course, here in the UK, there's a long tradition, as in all countries essentially, but of working with and crafting, you know, beautiful things out of wood. But it's really looking at those key traditions that, if you like, inspire us when we look at things. So that's kind of why we refer to those, you know, four traditions. Our brand, of course, as all businesses and brands do over the years, has evolved. It became quite clear early on that producing on a production batch basis in the workshop was not sustainable and still isn't to this day. And we first moved out of our own workshop in the village, if you like, to a slightly bigger one on the other side of London. But that too, quite quickly, you know, ran out of space. So we then moved to several production sort of factories in Portugal. And we now have three Portugal-based suppliers, as well as three UK-based suppliers. We still make all our upholstery in the UK. We have a couple of smaller workshops that can produce furniture pieces, but our principal supplier base is three factories in Portugal.
What is that importance of keeping some of it slightly closer? Why have you sort of fought to try and keep some of that?
We would happily make everything in the UK. I mean, you know, the closer you can make, the better in our view. If we could make everything here from even local timber, amazing. But it just isn't the case. I mean, the cost of labor and the setup in terms of third-party workshops is what it is. It's a different industrial environment here to ones in sort of northern Italy and Portugal and in other places, whereby just the cost of making is just too high. But also, actually, as important is the fact that the industrial manufacturing base in Portugal, and that includes ceramics and leather goods and apparel making, as well as furniture making, is quite advanced. I mean, the factories are really well equipped. They have the latest machines and technology. So not only is it cheaper to make from overhead, our point of view, but it's also quicker. You gain on both ends. Now, I'm not saying that the savings are tremendous, but they're enough to allow the business to have a more diversified number of sales channels. So we can make at a price and resell through other dealers around the world if we choose to do so. But most importantly, we can keep the prices at a level that I hope is deemed to be fair and accessible. You know, it's not cheap, but it's all prime grade timber, pretty much, you know, made, as you said, in Europe or UK to order by, you know, highly skilled craft people. And that still comes at a cost, but it is a very different cost to what it would be if I'd made everything here. And it might be higher than if we were to make, let's say, in much cheaper markets like Asian countries, for example, but that isn't their model. I don't have no interest in getting into that supply chain cycle. Essentially, what really matters is how you make it with what you make. So if you make with sustainable timber, you produce in factories that have appropriate sort of HR and labor controls so that people are well looked after, which I only say because it can happen that isn't the case in certain markets. It's not a problem for us, but a lot of companies do have to look out. And also you make in sustainable, so green factories as much as possible. So it matters to us how the factories heat themselves and do they run on green energy, do they have solar panels on the roofs and so forth. And also we are very keen as well on specifying the types of glues and finishes that we use, because unless we request it to do so, we don't use varnishes. So we try to use only oils and waxes and natural materials and natural finishes. And we're even going further now and trying to find zero VOC or non-toxic glues and finishes, so that not only is the item of furniture sustainably made in a sort of regional sort of production facility, but also when it comes to your house, it is not only packed in recyclable packaging, but also it's healthy for the home. In other words, it doesn't emit any fumes or any noxious VOCs, which can happen. Even our upholstery, for example, is entirely natural. So there's no foams, no fire retardants. So it isn't so much only where you make, it's really a question of how you make as well. So there's a bit of a puzzle, but ideally, if one had a way, it's about replicating the same sustainable model as close as possible to your consumers, wherever they might be?
Obviously, with shops shut at the moment and a lot of commercial businesses taking stock, with this time to reflect, do you imagine other makers or brands will be thinking, actually, we want to champion sustainability and actually sort of take a slightly different tack? Could this be the future for making?
We talk about this ourselves a lot. The challenge is about marrying craft and industry insofar that, again, cost matters, you know, price matters to people, obviously. And there's some wonderful makers out there and in the UK as well who make great things and they come at a price. So it's value for money, but only if you have the money. That's a small market, inevitably, you know, like any sort of luxury market is essentially. And then there's this big chasm to mass production and cheap furniture. And that's problematic. You know, if you look at obviously the cost of products by well-known brands without needing to mention them, that's a whole different world. And I think somewhere in between lies the answer, you know, so making responsibly, making well, making to last, really supporting good design, supporting quality manufacture, and also being really forward thinking in terms of R&D, because it isn't just about solid timbers. You know, solid timbers means just that. You have to take down a tree, but you can use different types of trees that have different rates of growth in more clever ways without going down the chipboard route, gluing the whole lot and sticking a, you know, vinyl on it. I think the question is, how do you produce sustainably? How do you produce well? How do you produce things that last at the right price and where? And I think in there somewhere lies the answer. The answer does not lie in micro production using coppice wood from Buckinghamshire. That has a role to play and it should be supported and celebrated, but it's not the answer. It's an important part of the conversation, but the answer in terms of making changes has to be bigger and broader and more impactful. So that is where I hope, you know, the bigger players will look at. And we think that way, although we're small, because we find it to be the most scalable way potentially of making a difference, you know, and that's why we think and work that way.
Ah, many and sincere thanks to Paul de Zwart there, founder and managing director of Another Country. He was speaking to the show's producer, Mae Lee Evans. And sadly, that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're game for a few more design-minded delights, then do listen to our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, that airs each Thursday. And do also subscribe so you don't miss a beat. For more delights, do seek out or subscribe to Monocle magazine on newsstand or online. Sign up to our daily bulletins or peruse our fine collection of books online. Then there's Monocle 24, our round-the-clock radio station. Head to monocle.com for more of that. Today's show was produced and edited by the ever-patient Mae Lee Evans. Thanks too to our researchers today, Nick Manise and Charlie Phil McCourt. Thank you both. I'm Josh Fennett, and lastly, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.